Today's podcast is sponsored by RadRx, your source for quality online education for interventional and diagnostic radiology coding, taught by subject matter expert Stacy Buck. For more information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Struggling to learn interventional radiology coding? If so, RadRx has the perfect solution for you. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology online training program. In this program, interventional radiology coding expert Stacy Buck breaks down the complexities of interventional radiology coding in easy-to-understand terms so you can grasp this complex specialty. Through her course, Stacy has assisted many coders with little or no interventional radiology coding experience in successfully passing the CIRC exam on the first attempt. For additional information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says, a podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level. And now, here's your host, Stacy Buck.
Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says. I am your host, Stacy Buck. I hope that everyone's new year has been off to a great start. Before I introduce today's guest, I want to let you know about a couple of exciting offers from RadRx. At RadRx, we have launched monthly subscription-based coding memberships, and we have three membership tiers so you can choose the one that best fits your budget. Whether you have questions you need answered or need to earn continuing education credits, we have options for you. As a Tier 1 member, you will have access to important industry updates, a question and answer database, coding tips, coding and billing articles, interventional and diagnostic radiology case studies, and you are permitted to submit one coding question per month, which will become a part of the Q&A database. We also have the entire NCCI manual and NCD manuals in searchable format. A Tier 1 membership is $33 per month. As a Tier 2 member, you will have access to all of the above, plus live monthly Q&A sessions with yours truly, Stacy Buck, and quarterly webinars for continuing education credit. Currently, we have one bonus webinar available for immediate viewing, the 2022 CPT coding update for interventional and diagnostic radiology. A Tier 2 membership is $99 per month. As a Tier 3 member, you will have access to both the Tier 1 and Tier 2 content. Plus, you may submit up to 10 cases per month for auditing and or consultation. Note that Tier 3 is limited to a total of only 12 members. Once all of those slots are full, you will have to wait for one to open to register as a Tier 3 member. Tier 3 is $399 per month. With any of our options, you also have the ability to pay for 12 months in advance to receive a discount. For more information on coding subscriptions, go to RadRx.com and click on the Memberships tab. Next, I am joining forces with Christine Hall of Sterling Global Solutions for an amazing two-day virtual event coming up on March 25th and April 1st. March 25th will feature topics for interventional radiology coders, and April 1st will feature topics for diagnostic radiology coders. You do not have to register for both days. You may register for a single day. The title of the event is Surviving Medicare's Recovery Room Radiology Edition, Keys for a Successful Operation. Interventional radiology sessions include evaluation and management coding today and tomorrow, staying compliant with telehealth today, and covering your assets, reducing risk, and ensuring accurate reimbursement for interventional radiology procedures. The diagnostic radiology sessions include, may I take your order, appropriate use criteria is coming, mastering medical necessity in ABNs, billing office diagnostics and portable diagnostics, and covering your assets, reducing risk, and ensuring accurate reimbursement for diagnostic radiology services. You may take advantage of early bird savings by registering before January 31st. You can save $50 with coupon code OPERATION22, That's Operation 22 to save $50 off of your registration before January 31st. You can find registration information along with a detailed agenda at radrx.com. Simply click on the Education tab, then go to the Webinar tab for more details. Today, I am super excited to release the first of three episodes with the one and only Victoria Mull of Contempo Coding and crazy YouTube fame. Victoria Mull has been in the medical coding industry since 2007. She has multi-specialty experience in professional coding, auditing, and risk adjustment coding. Victoria has published numerous articles on coding and billing best practices and has spoken at several local, regional, and national events, including HealthCon. Victoria serves on the AAPC Chapter Association Board of Directors for years 2021 to 2023 and is on the editorial board for BC Advantage Magazine. She has been featured on the Alpha Coding Podcast and the Not Elsewhere Classified Podcast. And of course, Victoria is best known for having her own dynamic YouTube channel filled with free coding tips, tricks, and tutorials. Her YouTube channel is quickly closing in on almost 50,000 subscribers in just under 2 years since she launched. That is simply amazing. In today's episode, Victoria shares how she got her start in the medical field of coding and how she came to launch her wildly successful YouTube channel. She also shares tips for aspiring YouTubers from equipment needed to get started and also how to monetize your YouTube channel. And now here is the first of my three episodes, A YouTube Star is Born with Victoria Mull. So I am super excited to have Victoria Mull on my podcast today. Victoria is a true coding celebrity, for sure. You need to start using that hashtag if you already haven't started using it. I joked with Brian Quee a while back about how sometimes I feel like a coding celebrity when I'm out and about, but I have nothing on you. You are the true coding celebrity, so I completely bow to you. And please start using that hashtag because you definitely are. So it's an honor to have you here on my podcast today. So thank you so much for taking time out of your super, super busy schedule.
Yeah, thanks, Stacey. I'm really happy to be here today. I will accept any podcast interviews that anyone asks for me. I haven't done one in a while, so I'm kind of taken aback because I'm like, seeing a lot springing up. No one's asking old Victoria to come on.
Well, you're so busy producing all of your own amazing content. I'm surprised that you would even have time to do podcast interviews. So I do appreciate you taking time out to talk with me. So I wanted first, before we get into, I really wanted to focus today on asking you questions about being on YouTube. That's really what I wanted to dig into because I want to learn from you. And I know other people would be interested in learning that whole process. But before we get into that, can you please share with the audience how you got into the coding profession? I'm always fascinated by that answer because we all kind of, I don't know if you fell into it like a lot of us or if you chose it, but a lot of us was like, oops, here I am. So what's your story?
Yeah. So I have, I love telling my intro story. It's always a good one. So when I was in high school, I was not a good student and I had no direction. I was just like, I was very goth. I listened to like Marilyn Manson and I had like the black nails and the black lipstick and arm warmers with stripes on them and those pants that had like the chains on them. And I was very, this was like right before the emo phase, but still very like, no one understands me and I'm such a misfit type of thing. And I really didn't know what the heck to do. Like I was just, I don't know. Like it wasn't that I wasn't smart. I just really didn't appreciate the process of like, oh, you have to study really hard so you can go to college and study really hard so you can get into a job where you have to work 60 hours a week. I'm like, that sounds horrible, all of it. I really just, you know, and I was in a situation with my family where college wasn't really super pressed upon me. Like I didn't have that pressure that a lot of people have where they're like, your parents are on your back and they're like, you have to get into a good college and you have to do this and that. My dad actually was the only person in his family. And he has like six brothers and sisters, two have graduated with even his associate's degree. A lot of them didn't even graduate high school at the time. I mean, the war was going on. So that was kind of a contributing factor to some of it. But in any case, My mom was a CNA, and she like had been doing nursing aiding since she was like 16, before you actually needed to have like an official process or license for it. They're just like, here's the patients, here's the med cart, figure it out.
It's amazing how things have changed.
Yeah. So she had come to me one day and was like, hey, Victoria, you know, I know you're not sure what you want to do when you graduate. She's like, there's this lady that works at the nursing home and she does this medical coding. Like she has her own office and she just sits in there with these books. Sometimes maybe she'll talk to the doctors, but she just like gets all the paperwork and the charts and like assigns these codes to things. And no one really bothers her. She seems to always leave on time. It seems like a pretty decent job. And I'm like, Mom, you have no idea what you're talking about. And that sounds incredibly stupid. And I went to college for web design, which has helped me out a lot now in what I do, because I know how to do some of the things like organize a website and design thumbnails and just kind of aesthetically know how colors go together and things like that. So that was helpful. But all in all, I really, you know, I was just like a couple of credits short of graduating. And I'm like, I just don't think I want to do this. I was going through like really bad depression at the time, really, really bad. And I'm like, I just want to get myself straightened out. So I dropped out of college, wound up using what skills I had learned previously through business courses and through office courses to do like secretarial jobs and file clerk jobs. Eventually I wound up working at a call center for a local department store, like in their online shopping department. So I would help the behind the scenes stuff of like when the online orders would go awry and someone would order 10 curtains and they'd only get 8 of them. And then we'd be like, yeah, they're out of stock, you know? Mm-hmm. So I really wanted something specialized. I wanted something with more job security. And at that point in my life, I had finally, you know, I was in like my mid-20s by then. And I'm like, you know, maybe my mom wasn't so stupid after all. Like you hit that point in your maturity where you're like, oh yeah, I guess my mom's not so dumb. So I'm like, let me think about this medical billing and coding thing again. I went back to the college and I was like, yeah, I said, I want to get into billing and coding. So I'm going to get into like the medical secretary program. Cause that looks like it has some coding and billing. They're like, okay, you don't want to be here. They're like, I want you to leave, go across the street to our career program center. They have a billing and coding program and they will get you done in like 9 months. And I'm like, oh, well, that sounds good. I'll go do that instead. And I was fortunate enough that I got a workforce grant. So I had my entire education covered by the state of Pennsylvania.
Awesome.
And it was like, you know, when I started doing it, a lot of the other people in the programs at the time were people who were like laid off factory workers who were going to career programs, that they were learning new job skills. So I was kind of like this superstar because I actually knew how to like write a resume and stuff.
Right.
And I really enjoyed the medical coding. It was a little bit difficult because, you know, Reading, Pennsylvania is a very impoverished area. So their program is targeted towards people who don't have a lot of money. So we weren't required to purchase even coding books. They're like, they had us use old editions that they kept in a bookshelf in the back of the room.
Oh, wow.
But I got to learn the basics of it. And at that time, it was literally that like just that beginning era of physicians being bought out by healthcare organizations and having to form the big physician groups. So my local hospital had just started forming their physician group and they were hiring people like crazy because they just needed everyone to work in the billing office. So I got a charge entry position, worked my way up from charge entry, you know, tried to get up in the same organization, but nothing was really available, I guess, at the times that I needed it. So I took a second job teaching at a local technical school and just really took every opportunity and built up from there. I wound up working then in the AR department. Like I did like a
short. So what did you teach? AR. What did you teach at the local technical school?
I taught intro to insurance. I taught basics of medical coding, advanced medical coding, and intro to HIM.
Wow. So you started teaching coding before you were before you actually had a coding position.
I was a CPCA, like I was freshly certified and they're just like, yeah, we just need someone and you're it. So here you go. because their coding program, I think, was fairly new at the time. They'd been teaching coding, but more so integrated into the medical assistant program. Mm-hmm. So this was new to them to teach like the actual curriculum for medical billing and coding, mm-hmm. for them to have that certificate. So yeah, I had a lot of medical assistants in some of my coding classes, which is always a struggle because they always have such great questions like, mm-hmm. can I just look this up in the EMR? This is dumb.
Right.
Yeah. They're not as enthused about it. But yeah, it was shortly after that that I finally got into my official coding role. And then I got more certifications. I started publishing articles. Like I basically at the time looked at like, I would open up Healthcare Business Monthly and be like, what are the leaders in the industry doing right now? And what can I start doing so that mm-hmm. I can get to where they are? Like, what are they doing that I can start doing now?
Awesome. So that is so interesting that you were teaching coding before you were an actual coder. So you were working in an entry level position, and that I find that like so fascinating. So then when did you finally make that transition into coding? Obviously the fact that you're teaching coding should now carry a lot of weight in landing that coding job. So how did you transition from the entry level position into actually a coding position?
It was tough. When I was trying to move up from charge entry, there were positions opening, but I was like, I guess kind of waffling on them a little bit, that I was like, oh, maybe I don't want to do the supervisor position, or I would apply for things that I personally felt I could do, but management didn't feel that I could do. There was one point where I think I'd applied for an auditing position, or more of a quality assurance, I guess, type of position. And I felt like I was a good candidate for it, but someone from management stepped down into that position. So I was like really frustrated because I was just applying and not getting anywhere. And that was when I had to really look and go, you know what? I'm not getting anywhere with this organization as much as I, you know, like my parents stayed with the same companies for basically almost their entire lives. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I was only there for maybe two and a half years before I'm like, this isn't working out and I'm going to have to go somewhere else because I'm not moving up and I'm not going to sit around and be bored all day doing the same thing. So that's when I got into accounts receivable. It's funny because I actually applied for accounts receivable and a coding position at the same time. And apparently they were going to offer me the coding position, but they took so long getting back to me that I wound up getting the AR request first and gave them a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, well, I'm just going to take the AR position because I'm not hearing back from the coding department. Come to find out, they were really annoyed that the AR people took me before they could grab me. So I stayed in there until I was allowed to transfer, which was about like 7 months later. So when people come and are like, coming and talking to me about claim denials and insurances, I'm like, I know 7 months worth of that. Like I haven't done a lot of back end billing resolution stuff.
Yeah. If you understand the coding though, I feel like that back end resolution stuff is a lot easier. I feel like that's really the key. If you're a knowledgeable coder, then the billing is the easier part to learn. At least that's the experience I had. I did a lot of coding before I ever did billing. And so then the billing piece was so, so much easier because of the coding knowledge and just an understanding of how that works.
Right. And I did do some when I was working. I used to lead a team of auditors and actually coders and auditors at one point. And when there were complex things that were constantly getting denied by the insurance company, you know, they would obviously intervene with us and go, okay, well, they're not paying this repeatedly. Is it because when you're coding it, you need to put on this modifier? Is Capital Blue mm-hmm. Cross not accepting it this way? So, but not to the intensity that it was like a daily thing like some people see.
Yeah. Billing, having done coding and having done billing, I don't like billing like at all. I don't like anything with accounts receivable. So the work I do now is completely like front end. And then if a client has an issue where they need me to chime in on a coding denial, I'm very clear. I will help you with coding denials. I am not here to look at any other denials other than coding related, because that you start getting into the weeds and a lot of other things. And I personally found like when I used to work in billing and work denials, the majority of the denials were due to front end issues that occurred at the time the patient was registered. And that was extremely frustrating to me that we're spending all this work on the back end because something was done incorrectly on the front end. So I like to do a process that I'm in control of. And when I'm doing the front end coding, I own that process and I give them the codes. And then it kind of removes me from the process, other than if they get a coding related denial, then I get pulled in. And I rarely have any of that work that I do for my clients. So that I think that's good. I assume no news is good news and everything's getting paid, you know, if they don't reach out to me. So that's amazing. I don't think I ever heard like your story or your background, but I just find that like fascinating. So you didn't choose it initially, like a lot of us, someone told you about it and then eventually you tried it out. But the fact that you were teaching before you had a coding position, I absolutely love that you were doing that prior to coding. So obviously, as you've progressed, teaching for me is a passion and my first love, and it probably is for you as well, I would assume, just like sharing your knowledge. So everyone knows you from YouTube. There are occasionally, I still run into people who do not know who Victoria Mall is. I mean, I find that shocking that they don't know. A lot of people do know if I bring up the name, oh yeah, she's great. And a few people still don't know who you are. But you have, how many, you know, subscribers do you have on YouTube? I think last time it was over 40,000 when I looked. Where are you at now?
Yeah, it's a little over 40,000. I gain a little over 100 subscribers daily. So statistically, in a couple months, I'll be at 50,000. My goal, and it's a superficial goal, I'll admit, but I want to get to 100,000 subscribers, because that's when YouTube allows you to get this big placard. It's called the silver play button. And when you get the silver play button, that's like kind of like when you've made it, when you hit the 100,000, and you get the cool placard with your channel name on it from YouTube.
That's awesome. So when did you start your channel? I don't think you started it that long ago, did you?
No, it's been about a year and a half. So really not, not that long. But yeah.
So then you'll probably be at the 100,000 mark, probably around year three.
Yeah. So there's a website I utilize called Social Blade. It's socialblade.com, and you can compare the data of YouTube channels and I think a couple other social media platforms. And it will kind of give you projections of like where you are now versus where you're going to be in a year and 2 years, et cetera. And so I believe it's by the end of 2023, like June of 2023 is when I'm predicted to get my 100,000 subscribers. And it's kind of interesting. I try not to go on it too much because you can also compare your channel to other channels.
Right.
And it's interesting though, to see the data, because there's, I think, one other coding channel that does have more subscribers than I do. But when you look at the data, I'm getting considerably more views than that channel is. So it's interesting, especially when people are like, I don't watch too many other content creators in this niche because I have interests otherwise. And I'd rather watch those than watching other coding creators. And also sometimes there's just, you know, I don't want to get influenced by what other people are putting together, I guess. But every now and then I'll cross someone who's like, it's your favorite medical coder. I'm the number one medical coder. And I'm like, well, I can prove by data that that's not true.
I love it. Yeah, no, it's true. With, you know, I spend a lot of time on social media. I'm not a YouTuber, but I'm always learning from social media people. And the focus is always, you're not necessarily looking at the number of followers you have or subscribers you have. They say you're better off with a smaller number of followers or subscribers who are actively engaged. There's really no value in having 100,000, you know, subscribers to your YouTube channel if maybe only 20,000 of those are regularly watching. And if you have 40, but the majority of your 40 are coming back to you over and over, then that's way, you know, a way better situation to have. So we tend to get caught up in some of those numbers with the follows and whatnot. Like I look at LinkedIn and I have probably, I don't know what it is now, 7,000 something people that I'm connected to and, you know, follow me. But when you look at that, how many of those people are actually active and engaged on LinkedIn? I find it's the same core people who are liking, sharing, you know, commenting. But I think a lot of people don't see the value in LinkedIn. They don't understand like what's there with all the changes that have occurred in LinkedIn. But anyway, I did a podcast on that. So if anybody wants to know more about LinkedIn, you can go back to a past podcast that I did. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what made you decide to start your YouTube channel? Now, it sounds like this coincided with COVID. Is that one of the things that pushed you to start the YouTube channel?
A little bit. It certainly made, I think, the pro like it was a good timing that I was starting right at COVID. But actually, it wasn't because of that that I started my YouTube channel. I started actually my first YouTube video I made was, oh my gosh, years ago, probably like 8 years ago, 7 years ago. But I'd only made one because at the time, so how do I say this? So I made one YouTube video because it was something I wanted to do. I had been an educator in the past. I was not satisfied with some of the education that was going out there, the webinars where it was just looking at the PowerPoint slides. I'm like, this could be more engaging. This could be like an interactive type of like I used to do in class. So I, at the time, was working a lot of wound care. So I did a video about talking about wound care and calculating sizes. It's still up on YouTube somewhere. For whatever reason, I don't know what account I put it under, so I can almost never find it, but it is there. And I, you know, as I progressed through my career and was doing more speaking engagements, doing more writing, I wanted to integrate some more creativity because I've always had that creative streak. Prior to medical coding, I used to be a blogger, not like a professional full-time job blogger, but I used to pop culture blog about like Transformers and My Little Ponies and cookies and movies and cartoons. And I thought it would be great to integrate some of that creativity, some of that humor into the medical coding realm.
Definitely.
So that's what inspired me to do my YouTube channel. Now, I didn't have the capacity to record a lot of videos until right around COVID hit. So when I was divorced, I was living with my dad, and he has a lot of loud TVs going on. You know, he's hard of hearing and doesn't want to get hearing aids. So it was just constantly loud in the house. And I'd actually been living with my father since my mother passed away from pancreatic cancer. He's like, you know, can you come live with me and I'll take care of the, I'll take care of your daughter so that you don't have to pay for daycare fees and stuff. And then you can come and live here and you can have reduced costs for your housing. And I was planning on getting divorced. So I'm like, well, this kind of works out. So I actually just purchased the house that I was in purposely to have a home office and a recording space because I was just starting out getting my education business together. I'd just become an approved instructor. And I was literally in this house for maybe like a couple of weeks before the whole shutdown happened from COVID. Wow. So I was already just in that process of starting to get videos together to publish and put online. And at the same time, you know, everyone was at home looking for something to do, looking for content to absorb. So it was really just kind of this perfect storm that wound up happening.
That's awesome. So when you started the YouTube channel, did you have any aspirations of monetizing it? I mean, obviously you can monetize YouTube, and I know that you do monetize YouTube. Were you thinking, hey, this is a way that I can build it and I can make a lot of money if, you know, this YouTube channel is successful? Or was that kind of secondary? Like, you were just doing it more for you and for fun. And then if I make some money from it, then, you know, that's okay too.
Yeah, it was kind of, it wasn't the target, but I thought, well, it could be a fun challenge to see if it's something that could be done. Because I would hear these like anecdotal comments online, like, oh, who wants to watch, you know, coding videos about YouTube, or who are YouTube videos about coding, or, you know, medical coding so boring. And I'm like, well, let me see what I can do with this. Like, I could probably put something together that's not going to be so boring or not going to be so dry that people would watch. You know, everyone has different interests, and there's certainly a lot of people that are interested in this career. And maybe I could even make some content about like exact, I like to create the content that's not like, like I'm a televangelist promoting everything about medical coding and it's like the savior to you because you're going to work from home and make $1 million. Right. I like to be like, this is what the career is. This is what the requirements are. These are the good skills that you might need as a medical coder. If that is something that fits you, then this would be a good career option for you. If you're someone who doesn't like to read a lot, it's probably not going to be a good job for you. So I thought it would be, you know, be good to get kind of some of that information out there and utilize some of those skills that I had from doing things like web design and doing things like creative blogging and move that into a rather dry realm. So it was more of a challenge to me. But of course, you know, I thought it would be cool, like, to get to monetize my channel. I had learned ahead of time, like, how to do that, how the YouTube monetization tactics work, like what the requirements are. So it was always a goal, but you know, I'm still, I think at this point, learning like how far I can kind of take this.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it was a secondary goal. It wasn't a primary goal when you started out. I mean, we all want to make money from our, from right. our content and monetize. So, you know, you mentioned how coding is so dry and boring, and I can relate to that. And all I ever do is talk about coding. And someone suggested that I should start a YouTube channel. And I said, no, I really don't like being in front of a camera. I'm not going to do it. I like podcasting because I don't have to be on camera. That's a whole nother level, you know, of work and editing and putting that together that I'm not interested in. But when I asked people, what would you want me to talk about? They were giving me all coding topics. And I said, you know what? Yeah. I don't want to talk about coding because it's boring. It's dry. I don't even know how to make that fun. So I like this podcast because I'm not talking about coding. I'm talking about the profession, which I enjoy, but I'm not talking about coding. So I love the creativity that you use in a lot of your videos. And so there's something I have to share with you. I have a friend of mine who does not work in healthcare. She is an IT project manager. So she's like a programmer, project manager. That's her background. And probably earlier, sometime earlier this year, she was telling me, oh, you should start a YouTube channel. And I'm like, nah, I'm not really into that. And I go, but these are some people that I know in the space, they're doing YouTube. And so I gave her some links to check out. And it's funny, she went and looked at something that you had recorded, and then she would get notifications when you were coming on live. Okay, because she had gone and she had looked at something, and it would pop, you know how YouTube will pop things, you know, up for she would sit and watch your YouTube like live, like she would, and she's not even in the field, and she's like, she is so great at making the content interesting. Like she just absolutely loved your delivery. And then the one episode that she happened to get the notification on the one day was the episode I was there in the background kind of chatting with you when you were celebrating your 25,000 subscribers. And she's like, oh my, she's texting me. She's like, you're on like two, like at the same time. So she's watched multiple episodes. So that's a testament to how you have very engaging content, because you have someone who's not even in the industry and knows nothing about medical coding that actually has watched multiple videos of yours. So I just thought that was super funny. And I had to share that with you.
I've actually thought about starting a second channel regarding more of my business entrepreneurship stuff, because that is a much wider sort of net that I can cast. And I, not because I want it to be, you know, oh, I'm going to be super popular and I'm going to be this big influencer, but again, the challenge, like I would like to see if I can do that, if I could take a business entrepreneurship channel and make it successful.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great idea, because I like talking about those types of things. I won't do it on YouTube. That's kind of, I kind of do it a little bit in this podcast. Like, I mean, I talked about becoming an entrepreneur and like all that. So that's kind of like where I'm going. You won't have any YouTube competition for me anytime soon, I promise. I might do it to the extent of YouTube. I might start doing like videos here and there, like maybe quarterly, but I have no desire to go full on in YouTube unless I could have the professional studio and the hair and makeup people and all that good and like fun stuff and have someone to do my editing. That just does not, the podcast is easy to edit. Mm-hmm. The YouTube editing, again, if it's going to take a lot of time, I'm not interested in doing it. So I feel like you, looking at the subscribers that you have for your YouTube channel, I feel like you're an overnight success. Like people say there's no such thing as an overnight success, but I truly feel like you were an overnight success, because I went from never hearing of you ever before to then hearing about you all of the time and like seeing you like everywhere. And I'm like, where did she come from? How have I not, you know, heard about Victoria, you know, before? So were you surprised by the level of success you achieved so quickly? I mean, did you ever anticipate that you would get so many subscribers so quickly?
Honestly, I didn't have expectations. I really wasn't sure. Like I kind of thought it would be popular, but I wasn't expecting it to be so popular that it would basically replace my auditing income from just the channel and affiliate income alone. So that was surprising to me. And it was funny too, because, you know, a lot of people were of the same mindset of you. They're like, oh, here's Victoria. And where the heck did she come from? And I'm like, I've been speaking at conferences and publishing articles for years. it's, I think a little bit more saturated the industry right now because of what happened with the pandemic. You know, when I started out, it was very new to do this kind of stuff. And I don't want to say, I shouldn't even say new. The way it was, I was doing it, I guess, was a little bit more new. And
yeah, I mean, the way that you do your episodes, your content, the way you produce your episodes, they are different from what's out there. I feel that the other YouTubers that are in the space, I feel that your content is done. It's the best. It's the best produced. It's the most engaging, because I've watched a lot of different people on YouTube and they all have value. Everyone has something to contribute from their perspective, but I feel like your production and your content is on a whole nother level from those that are out there. And I feel that's why you've grown so quickly, because you have others that have been around for years that don't have the numbers that you have. They're popular, but they're not even close. I mean, I can't think of anybody close to your numbers. I mean, you said you kind of looked at other ones out there. Is there anybody in the space, the coding space, that'd be close to what you do with those numbers? I can't think of anyone.
There is Codemaster Coach. She has, I think, a little over 50,000 subscribers and has been doing this a little longer than I have. But again, statistically, the view count is not close to what I'm getting.
I've not heard of that. Yeah. Interesting.
I think she may have taken a hiatus for a while, and that's maybe why. But yeah, the videos I think are more targeted towards students, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But really, I feel like your content is even valuable to those who are in the profession, as well. There's a lot there, because the reason being is that coding is so broad, and some of us have that niche like I do. And then others, are in a different niche. So when I listen to you, I'm learning stuff that I don't know, because I just don't work in that space and I don't do that. So I think there's value for those who maybe want to try something a little bit different from what they're doing. So I definitely recommend you to students. I just did a meeting. It was a student forum last week, and they were asking about podcasts to listen to. And so I gave them a list, and then I said, YouTube, you definitely have to get on YouTube, check out Contempo Coding, Victoria Mall. And some people in the chat were saying, I love Victoria, I watch her stuff. So some students already knew about you, which is awesome. And I know I've also seen on social media that there are some instructors, they use your videos in class, like with their students. I've heard that as well. So that's pretty amazing.
That's actually a big portion, I think, of where some of the views come from is from colleges and universities and instructors linking to the videos, which I'm fine with, as long as they're linking to it, pointing that direction, as long as they're not basically creating a course that's just my videos or downloading them and embedding them into their course. Right. I'm fine with that. I was actually just contacted a couple weeks ago by the University of Phoenix so that they could get permission to link to a bunch of my videos to supplement some of the material in their curriculum. And there's a university in Florida, I want to say it's over towards like the Panhandle area, that the director of their ADA department said that they're utilizing a lot of my videos in their curriculum, but the closed captioning is a little bit messy because it's just YouTube's automatic closed captioning. There's no like punctuation or capitalization and stuff. So they've been correcting or completing the closed captioning for a whole bunch of my YouTube videos and sending me the files so I can upload and update the closed captioning like for free. They're just like, our students are needing this in their hard of hearing, so can you do it? And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. You can whatever work you want to do for me for free, I'm fine with that.
Definitely. That is so awesome. Okay, so the big question, there are a lot of people out there who talk about maybe doing a podcast or doing a YouTube channel. And one reason that people want to get into it is that monetization. That is the pull for some people. They see these huge YouTube stars and they're making all this money off of, being on YouTube. So how exactly does the monetization like work? Is there a minimum number of subscribers that you need to have? Just kind of, walk me through that process. I know nothing about that process. So if you could enlighten me and my listeners, that would be awesome.
Yeah. So the requirements to get money from the YouTube Partner Program, which is when YouTube will run ads on your videos and you receive a monetary compensation for part of that. You have to have 1,000 subscribers to your channel, and you have to have 4,000 watched hours within a 12-month period, so within a year. So if you hit month 12 and you're just short of that, it's not gonna, you basically, it's a 12 rolling years, or it's a 12 rolling month rather. So it has to be within a 12 calendar year, mm-hmm. calendar month period. And the income that you get from ads is very small. They have what they call a cost per mil. So the amount of money that you earn per 1,000 views. And mine, I think, is higher for some reason than some other niches, like things like the makeup niche and the beauty niche. They're so oversaturated that there's not as much funds to go around to everyone. Mm-hmm. So the money that you would earn for 1,000 mm-hmm. views in that niche is probably a lot less than I would earn in my niche because there aren't as many videos. So I think mine is like $13 or something for 1,000 views, something like that. Mm-hmm. But in any case, you get paid by your views. So when I upload a video, I can click on where I want to insert the ads. I can put them at the front. I can put them at the end. Anything over 8 minutes, you can put them in the middle. So it's a balance to make sure that you're not putting in so many ads that people are going to mm-hmm. click off of the video because they don't want to watch it. And then anyone who has a premium membership to YouTube, you get a little bit of monetization from that too. When you hit, I think they changed some of the numbers, but there are certain intervals that you can hit where they'll open up like a community to you. So you can have almost like a feed of just text and image postings that will go out to your channel subscribers. You can also have what they call super chats. So if I'm doing a live video, someone can just send me a super chat of however much money they want. It could be $2. It could be $20. I think the top is like $500 that they can just send you just because they like you and want to support you. Mm-hmm. I also have channel memberships. I think there's a few thousand subscribers you have to unlock memberships. They've been kind of quiet about how they're unrolling that. And then you can set tiers. So you can set them for as little as like 99 cents a month just to subscribe and support your channel, or you can set them much higher. And it's kind of like Patreon, if you're familiar mm-hmm. with Patreon. So it's basically people who want to support your channel. You can offer something to them if you want. Like you're like, hey, channel members are only going to get extra videos, or they'll get an exclusive podcast, or they'll get behind the scenes footage or whatever. So I offer at my top tier, like behind the scenes footage. Everyone at my mid and high tier gets their names added to the end credits. They all get community only posts. They all get custom mm-hmm. emojis. So between the ad money and the membership funds, I get probably about $3,000 a month.
Wow.
And that's starting to go up. So a year from mm-hmm. now, it's going to be a lot more. Yeah. But a lot of work goes into it. So that's mm-hmm. that's the other thing. It's not, it's when you're aiming for those sort of numbers, it's not point the phone at your face or record a webinar right. on Zoom and throw it up on YouTube anymore. It's a lot more intense than that. But then there's also affiliate income. So if there's products that I like, I can recommend them to my viewers, and my affiliates will send me some income based off of that. Now, there are strict Federal Trade Commission guidelines stating how that has to get disclosed, that I have to say, hey, I'm going to send you to like Amazon. Amazon's a big, easy one. Basically, anyone can get an Amazon affiliate account where if someone buys something on Amazon, you get a small, small portion of that income, but it doesn't add any extra cost to the consumer. But you have to disclose that. Mm-hmm. You have to say, this is an affiliate link. If you click it, I am going to get a commission off of it. And you can say, you know, it's to support me or the channel and that sort of thing. And again, there are regulations. Like if you don't disclose, Amazon can kick you off their program. And again, it's a Federal Trade Commission regulation. One of the things that I found interesting lately is, you know, when I have to send to someone an affiliate link, and I just off the topic before I forget, I make about $2,000 a month just on affiliate income alone.
Wow.
So when I send someone an affiliate link, I have to disclose that there are regulations about social media influencers saying that if you're getting monetary compensation or you're getting a free product, you have to tell someone. What I've noticed though in our industry is there are now companies that are telling their employees, oh, if you refer someone and we employ them, you'll get a monetary compensation. So now I'm seeing things on Facebook, on LinkedIn, all over social media. Hey, come and apply to work to my company. And then tell them that I sent you, because I'll make sure that they get your resume and that my boss, you know, will know to look at you and that you're good, and I'll kind of get you in. Not disclosing the fact, in the world of booing physician kickbacks, that they will get a monetary compensation if they wind up hiring you. So I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of interesting to me, because I'm not far enough into, you know, legalities of things to know what defines a social media influencer in the eyes of the FTC. And should these people really be disclosing the fact that they are going to get compensated by their company if they end up hiring you?
Interesting. I definitely need to look into like affiliate links. That was something that there was a podcast I listened to last month that talked about affiliate links. I have so many ideas I want to implement for my business, and affiliate links was one of them. And with the goal being like, so with YouTube, you didn't start making, you know, $3,000 a month, like right away. That's like over the course of time. It's like incremental.
Yeah.
And then you have the affiliate income. So it's more of what I'm trying to think of for myself. And this is why I want to pick your brain on certain things, is just trying to, I have multiple sources of income, but adding multiple streams of income. And then for myself, what I'm guilty of is what can make me that large amount of money, like boom, like right away, like that pop. Because I have my online course that the majority of that is profit, and that's like cha-ching, and I'm like super happy with that. But looking at other ways of making money, I'm like, there's nothing else I can do that's going to bring me that return that quickly. So what are some other things that I can do that are smaller? But when you add up three or four other smaller streams, then it becomes a significant amount. So you just said you've built up to over time, 3,000, you know, with YouTube ads, or no, so 3,000 on YouTube and then 2,000 from affiliates. That's $5,000 a month for putting in that work over time. You didn't start out doing that, but shoot, that's pretty amazing that you can count on that much a month, you know, for just what you're already, you know, doing and adding to it. So yeah, I may want to talk to you more like one-on-one about the, if we get to see each other, I don't know if it'll occur, you know, in a couple of weeks or if it'll occur in January, but talk to you a little bit more about affiliates and how that works, because right now I'm going to look at doing something that's membership based, and I'm looking at Patreon to do that. So the information that you shared there was definitely helpful. So for someone who's thinking about starting a YouTube channel, what advice would you give to an aspiring YouTuber?
The advice that I would give is to get started with whatever equipment you have. I think a lot of people hold themselves back because they think, oh, I don't have a good camera. Oh, I don't have this. Oh, I don't have that. I don't have the editing software. You know, there are YouTubers out there that record on their phone. That's how I started out. I recorded on my phone. After I started, you know, pocketing enough money away, I got like a clip-on mic to plug into my phone. I started upgrading just gradually as I started going through. So if you wait for that perfect storm of everything to happen, like there's never going to be that perfect situation. You're never going to feel 100% confident. You know, I have tips and tricks about how to gain some camera confidence. Certainly not an expert on it, but there are channels out there that will guide you 100% through the process of this is how you record, edit, upload completely on your mobile device. And mobile devices now have great audio. They have great great video. There's nothing wrong with them. You can even, if you have an area where you can get natural lighting, that's usually the best, is to get in front of a window. But there are, you know, affordable alternatives, and there's resources out there to find out what those affordable alternatives are to start up. The other thing I would say is if you're aspiring to be a YouTuber in this field, you also have to be cautious about copyrights. So I've seen some people, you know, they will show you how to go through an entire book. So there are copyright laws. Like you can't basically take an entirety of a copyrighted material, a movie, a book, and show it. What would be the large amount of content. It's a little bit gray as far as what is considered fair use. I will probably at some point be consulting a fair use attorney to make sure that what I'm doing is okay. Because fair use law can really only be determined in court. Like a lawyer, you can take things to them and go, okay, I'm going to sample this and this. Is this okay? Could you defend this as fair use? And they will tell you, yes, I feel it can. But that doesn't mean that someone's going to come and still slap you with a lawsuit. And certainly the AMA has a lot deeper pockets than I do.
Yes. Yes.
So I'm very cautious about showing like, this is how you look up a code, but I'm not going to show you all of the guidelines in the book. I'm not going to show you substantial pieces of content. I'm not going to show you how to work through your entire code workbook. I have a video where I show, because CPT and ICD-10 are different. ICD-10 data you can get for free. CPT, not so much. So I have a video where I show, okay, here's how, where you can download all the files for and merge them together to kind of make like an ebook. So if you don't have money, like here's how you can kind of finagle some things together. And I always get comments, well, where's the one for CPT? Well, let me tell you, you have to buy a CPT book because they're very protective of their copyrights.
Yeah. So I will share a story with you about AMA fair use. This is something that I learned from personal experience. So this was many years ago at the other company that I used to work for, the billing and consulting company, where I was putting out a, I think it was a week on a weekly basis. I think it was weekly. It might've been every other week. It doesn't really matter, but it was like an e-newsletter. And it would talk about radiology, coding, and billing like issues. And so I sent this out and we probably had like 1,000-something people that subscribed to it that would get this whenever I would put it together. Well, during this same time, this had been going on for a while, there was a product that I wanted to sell. So I had to go to the AMA and you have to go through the application process and they have to approve your product and all that. And you give them all your company information. Well, in that process, they go out to the company website and they see that I have these archived on the website, these free e-newsletters that were going out. And they said to me, you cannot do that. You have to pay an AMA royalty on every person that is receiving that newsletter. Now it's free. I'm not making any money. And I said, well, what about fair use? I said, I believe that this constitutes fair use, going back and looking at what AMA has to say about that. They said, one newsletter on its own constitutes fair use, but now you have created this body of knowledge because collectively they violate fair use. So either you stop the newsletter or you pay a royalty on every person that's receiving that. Well, it's not generating an income. So guess what I did? It got completely nixed. And I had to like, you know, do away with that. So that's just one example there. And I'll just put this out to the audience because we're on the subject of AMA, that people don't realize how much money the American Medical Association charges and how protective they are over things. And I see a lot of people doing a lot of things that they feel like, well, I can share. You got to be really careful about what you share. You just do on social media, anything that's printed, anything that's copyrighted. That's just a major issue I see across the board. But with AMA, and this again goes back to, well, why don't I get free products? Why don't I get free CEUs and all this stuff? And why can't I have, you know, all this stuff for free? You know, as a content creator, there are a lot of fees behind the scenes that customers are not aware of. So when you're doing a print product that involves CPT codes, the AMA, you have to have a contract with them. You have to pay a royalty. Now, how this works, this changed a few years ago. This didn't used to be the case. But they changed it to where now you have to pay a minimum fee. I don't know if you have a contract with them for anything you're doing. You may not. But you have to pay them a minimum fee of $1,000 per year just for the privilege of having a contract with them, even if you never sell one product. It's a minimum $1,000 a year. Then on top of that, you pay them a royalty per user, per subscriber, whatever, you know, your model might be, whether it's an electronic access or it's printed access. And that fee has been going up steadily over the years. I think when I started with them, it was like $15.50 a person. Now I think it's $17.50. I think it's going to go up to $18. Like they've been incrementally, oh, and the minimum royalty, excuse me, went up to $1,050. They've increased that. So they're constantly bumping those prices up. So you have content creators who are having to absorb these costs and pay these fees. So when we're charging you for a product, we have to build this into the price of the product. And I don't think that people realize that. I want to give you low cost stuff. But when I have to pay the AMA and I have to pay AAPC approval fees and I have to pay RCCB approval fees, it's a very large expense. So while you're getting a lot of free CEs from large companies who have the budget to do that and absorb that, the smaller content creators just aren't going to have that budget, especially if you're in a situation with AMA where you're offering something where you have to pay a royalty on every single person that has access to it. And so those of you that are out there listening, that's kind of the secret behind why you don't necessarily always find the free content that you're looking for. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. And I told my friend, again, who works in IT, we were talking the other day about something, and I mentioned something about a product idea that I had, which I think is an awesome product idea. And I said, the problem is with this product, it should be a low cost product. The problem is I have to factor in the AMA royalty to this at like $18 a person, where I should be able to sell the whole product for like $19.99, which I can't do because you've got production cost and then you've got that. So then you're talking, adding it. She goes, well, wait a second, why are you paying a fee? And I explained to her about the AMA and she was in shock. And I said, the AMA, that is their primary source of income, is the CPT royalties. I said, think about every person who's using software with CPT codes in it, anything that has CPT codes in it, they're getting money. I'm like millions and millions, I don't know how many millions a year. And I said, they're a very political organization, so they're never gonna let go of that revenue stream. They've got, I mean, that's a sweet spot there where we have to do what we have to do, you know, and work with them and contract with them and pay these fees. And she's like, but they're codes, you should be able to talk about them and do that. I'm like, you're right, we should. I go, but because it's copyrighted and they own it. Again, like you said, Victoria, it's different from ICD-10, yeah, where it's public and you can take that information and you can use it and repurpose it without any issues. And that's why, listeners, if you're not seeing a lot of CPT content out there, that is the barrier. It is not that we don't want to offer it. It's that cost factor and all the legalities of putting CPT information out there. So hopefully we did a little education on that for the audience today, but that is a hurdle that we have to like come up with. So, okay. We talked a little bit about advice that you would give to an aspiring YouTuber. Now I found when I was starting my podcast, I found a YouTube channel called Think Media, and I found that to be helpful just with the basics of setting up a podcast. Like that's how I chose my podcast microphone, which I spent like $60 for. I didn't want to put a lot of money into it. So I found Think Media is very helpful. If anybody's looking, they tell you how to start a YouTube channel, how to start a podcast, equipment. They review different pieces of equipment. And you, you know, Victoria, you talk about how some people start with their phone. And really the key is just get started, because what it comes down to, like looking at different YouTube content, it's about the quality of the content. It's not necessarily about the quality of production, because you could have something perfectly produced that looks pretty, or the content just sucks, to just put it bluntly, where there's really not a lot of value in the content. So while it may be pretty to look at, there's not much value in it. So I would much prefer to have someone recording on their phone, giving me valuable information, than have someone that's sitting with the perfect lighting and the perfect production and, you know, all of that going on.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that some people miss as well is that YouTube is a search engine. So even if you have that wonderful piece of content out there, if you don't have it titled correctly, described correctly, tagged correctly, so that it comes up in search, no one's going to find it. And a lot of people feel, or I guess maybe misunderstand, that they think that they can just take videos and share them with their friends or post them on LinkedIn or post them on Instagram. But in order to really get higher views, you have to target the audience that's already on YouTube.
That brings us to the end of part one of my interview with Victoria Moll. Don't forget to mark your calendars for February 8th for part two of my interview with Victoria. As always, I want to thank all of my listeners. If you are loving the podcast and you listen on Apple, please take a moment to give the podcast a 5-star rating and leave a review. And of course, as always, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you have feedback you'd like to share in an episode or have a topic suggestion, please send an email to podcast@radrx.com. That's podcast@radrx.com. And I still would love to start an Ask Stacy segment, so don't be shy. Please submit any questions you would like answered in a future episode to Ask Stacy. That's askstacy@radrx.com. Thanks again for tuning in and have an amazing week.
Thank you for listening to Who Cares What Stacy Says? You can connect with Stacy on social media. You can find her business page for RadRx on Facebook, and you can connect with her personally on LinkedIn. Don't forget to check out the online training courses offered by RadRx. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology Online Training, or Cracking the Diagnostic Radiology Code Online Training. Thanks again for tuning in to Who Cares What Stacy Says? A podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level.